yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to pick up and talk about the ACA and the accelerating costs of healthcare in the U.S. but we've been trumped by Trump once again. And the NAFTA discussions, ACA discussions in Congress are going rather slowly. So there's not a lot of new news here. I will be posting sort of a foundation analysis of why healthcare costs are so high in the U.S. And maybe we'll pick that theme up next week. But the real discussion this week, both domestic and foreign, of course, is Trump. Trump has come out of the block swinging. On a whole number of fronts here, establishing government by executive order. By the way, you know, for all the right-wing discussions and demands about the U.S. Constitution and glorifying the Constitution, you know, which really was the coup document, the Constitutional Convention was really an event organized by a very small minority of plantation owners and bondholders and merchants in the U.S. Who wanted to do something about the lack of ability to control the farmers, independent small farmers, who were running amok, they thought, in the 1780s after the U.S. Revolution, and being too democratic, actually taking over the state houses and refusing to pay taxes. Because the taxes were being used by the state legislatures to pay the bondholders, both U.S. And foreign. You know, the Dutch and the French wanted their payment after the war, but the U.S. was broke. It had no money. So what they did was force the local taxes being raised by the states to pay the bondholders. And the farmers said, no, we're not going to do that. We fought this war. And they were taking over the state houses, and that's what prompted the plantationists and the merchants and the rich bondholders to hold the Constitutional Convention to reconstruct the government so that the bondholders get paid. By the way, two-thirds of all those delegates, there's only 50, 60 of them, at the Constitutional Convention were bondholders and got to be paid. Talk about conflict of interest by leaders. Well, that goes right back to the founding of this country, right? And, of course, the new Constitution solved that economic issue, so they got paid. They got paid off because now the federal government took over tariffs and taxes and took over all the lands and started selling the lands to speculators. And that's how the new federal government, central government, after 1787, had revenue. And, of course, they paid off the bondholders. And the states went along with it because it got the farmers off their back. That was how the Constitution was formed. There were economic reasons for the Constitution being formed. It's a very economic document. And the whole idea of structure and balance, the checks and balance and so forth, built into it, the whole idea of checks and balances was really designed to do something about these uppity farmers who were taking over the state legislatures. We got to stop that. And the whole idea of a two-house Congress, you know, representatives and Senate, the states did not have that. Only one state had a two-house conference, that constitution, and that was Maryland. All the rest had a single parliament. Well, we got to get rid of these parliaments. You know, it gives too much opportunity for small parties, and a whole number of other things were baked into that constitution to check the people. the check and balances was to check the people. Anyway, all this talk about, you know, Constitution, by the Trumpists and the right wing, you know, making a fetish out of that Constitution, which was really an economic document on behalf of plantationists, you know, to establish fundamentally and to bake into law the slave system. It really was a coup document, a conservative coup, and that you know, that's what the right wing, for many reasons, you know, makes a fetish of the Constitution. But the Constitution does not say anything about presidential executive orders. It does not say that the president can govern by executive order. But yet that's what we have, right? This all begins, this fetish with executive orders begins with the imperial presidency being established after World War II and giving the president the authority to take all these military and political actions through executive orders so the Congress does not have to take responsibility for it. So executive orders are a problem, you know? Problem and gives too much. They give too much power to the president. Ah, but what we see Trump coming out with executive orders, it's not in the Constitution. No, 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 nowhere. But they've allowed that power to legislate effectively, in essence, on legislate presidential legislation. Right? That's what it is. It has the force of law. Those aren't just recommendations. They have the force of law. Well, just a little history. A lesson there for everyone about the origins of executive orders, because that's what we're going to see a lot now. While Congress focuses on developing the new corporate investor tax giveaway, the latest here, which won't really be resolved until the summer, maybe late summer, and while Congress tries to come up with a counter solution to the Obamacare ACA without pissing off 20 million people who have some sort of insurance through it, right? They're going to try to craft something here. But that will take them a lot of time here. You won't see anything in terms of a final version until late summer once again. And deregulation, of course, the deregulation starts with Obamacare and Dodd-Frank, financial regulation bill. But in the meantime, while Congress is focusing on tax cuts for corporations and deregulation of business, what you're going to see is a government by executive order, Trump. And boy, he came out swinging this week, didn't he? We'll talk about that. You know, keep in mind that executive orders are not really embedded in the Constitution. Those are powers given to the president over the course of the centuries, decades, especially since World War II, and especially they have their origins in presidential action on starting wars and so forth. Right? Okay, so with that little background, let's just jump into the week that was here, and what do we see? Well, we see at the very beginning of the week executive orders on immigration, right? Several of them. And what did they actually define here by Trump? Well, one of them is an executive order to build the wall, right? And that issue leads to who pays for the wall. That was supposed to be negotiated, at least negotiations begin with Trump's meeting with President Peña Nieto of Mexico, right? You know, he started talking about Mexico's going to pay, and a border tax maybe. Well, that really got people upset. You know, you can talk about Mexican pay, and you can make Mexican immigrants in the U.S. who send remittances back to Mexico and their families, make them pay. But when you start talking about a border tax, well, that kind of upsets business interests in Mexico and in the U.S. to some extent. And, well, Somebody told Peña Nieto to stay home, and he did. Okay, well, we got a big flap here, right? The first big flap of in the first week of the Trump regime here, right? Trump, of course, bashing Mexico. It's easy to bash Mexico, right? It's harder to bash China. And who do we have the bigger deficit with, Mexico or China? Well, the deficit with Mexico is about $100 billion. In other words, the difference between what they sell us and we sell them. By the way, most of what they sell us is really American companies selling back into the United States with no tariff, no tax. See, most of it's American companies that relocated down there, you know, auto parts and other companies, PC companies, et cetera, and they just ship the stuff back across the border. So, you know, it's not Mexico, it's American companies in Mexico who are the big beneficiaries. Well, but, you know, we have about $100 billion trade deficit with Mexico. What's the trade deficit with China? Huh? Well, China sells us almost $500 billion a year, $480-something billion dollars of goods and services. We sell them back about 130. So we run about a deficit of Mexico of well over $300 billion a year. But it's easier to bash Mexico, you see. Much easier. But the problem is Peña Nieto is in deep doo-doo down in Mexico. You know, a terrible, terrible president. And his popularity, I'm not sure if it's down into the single digits. It's pretty damn close. Ever since Trump got into office, of course, the Mexican peso has collapsed because of investors realizing that, the doo-doo is going to get deep in Mexico as a result of Trump. The peso has been collapsing. Well, about 15%. It recovered a little bit, but it'll go back down again. 15% in just a couple months, almost. Terrible. Why? Well, you know, when you have a collapse of your currency like that, your import inflation accelerates. In other words, everything is more costly to import. And, of course, Mexican workers and families there are on the edge. And to pay more for imports as a big whack on their standard of living. And not only that, higher import prices, but when the currency declines, what happens is the central bank tries to protect the currency, keep it up there, so it raises interest rates. Well, interest rates slow down the domestic economy. So on top of import inflation, you've got more unemployment as higher interest rates slow production and investment, and therefore employment and jobs, and therefore income. So Mexican workers are getting whacked for both ends. At the same time, the Mexican government eliminates subsidies for oil, for gasoline. We have gas riots down in Mexico now, okay? It's going to be very interesting what goes on in Mexico in the next year, because the U.S. and Trump is really putting the screws to it and making things worse. Well, with his popularity, down near single digits, President Peña Nieto just can't come to the U.S. And get bashed by Trump even more. And probably his business elites tell him, no, you don't want to do that. You're playing into his hands. So he says, no, I'm not coming. And so Trump's response? Well, in his press conference, he says that both countries have decided to cancel the meeting. And then he says, I'm going to do something by other means. So let's see what the other foot dropping really looks like by Trump here, because something else is going to happen. And we have a trade war brewing with Mexico, of all places, right? He was talking about the trade war brewing with China. Well, it's easier to pick on Mexico, and that's exactly what the U.S. is doing here. At the same time, you know, we have another interesting development, and that is here comes Prime Minister Theresa May from the United Kingdom, Britain, hat in hand here, comes to the U.S., comes to the Republican gathering refuses to meet with Democrats, right, comes to Republican Party congressional retreat where, you know, Trump and his minions there in Congress getting together and syncing up their programs, right? So he comes, she comes, and, you know, she is looking for a way out of Brexit, you know. What's happened in the UK is the Brexit has been announced and is being delayed, dragged out. And that's exactly what the ruling traditional elites and corporations and bankers over there want. They want to drag out the Brexit. Don't implement the Brexit, and let's just give it time and find a way to stop it or dilute it significantly, but prevent it. That's the strategy. It's a delaying strategy over there by the business elites, and it puts May in a corner. So May came out a couple of weeks ago and says, we are going to announce Brexit here in March. And the courts and Parliament are ganging up on her, and they're saying, oh, no, 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 you got to put let Parliament vote on this to activate Article 50 to start the negotiation. So there's a battle going on between the Brexiters, who've taken over the Tory party over there, the Conservative Party, and want a quick exit, and those forces in Britain that are trying to prevent it. Well, May is playing her Trump card, pun intended here, and she's come to the U.S., and she wants this special relationship with the U.S. In other words, a free trade deal, a new one between the U.S. and U.K. Now, that may appeal to Trump, because Trump wants an example of a one-on-one bilateral free trade agreement. Trump is not against free trade. You know, he may have given the deep six to the TPP, but he's a bilateral free trader. That's what he is. He just wants to improve a U.S. business share of the deals. He's not out to get rid of NAFTA. You know, he's not out to reverse all the free trade deals. He just wants to get a bigger share for his boys. That's all. That's what this is all about. The same impact is going to occur on workers nonetheless, and on the environment and so forth of all these free trade deals on sovereignty, et cetera, nonetheless. He is not against free trade. He is a bilateral free trader. That's the fact that you don't really see in the media. You don't see that kind of a position interpretation being made. Okay, a lot of talk about, oh, Trump is going to be a protectionist. No, he's not a protectionist. He just wants to reshuffle the free trade deck. That's all. And all this threats of a trade war and so forth are bargaining chip, right? Okay, but the trying to start it out with redoing the deal with Mexico, not Canada, by the way, Mexico. Not NAFTA, it's Mexico, part of NAFTA. That kind of fell apart. You know, when Peña Nieto says, no, no, we're not going to be the first out of the box here on renegotiating bilaterally a deal better for you. Well, Theresa May is behind the eight ball, and she says, well, we'll do it, we'll do it. You know, raises her hand, rushes over to the U.S., and plays on this you know, phony special relationship BS between the U.S. and the U.K., you know, make it sound like Churchillian here, right? And, of course, we know Trump likes Churchill, right? Yeah, he's even got a picture of him now. You know, took down Martin Luther King in his Oval Office, put Churchill up there. You know what his other picture is that he likes? Richard Nixon. Yeah, one crook to another, right? He likes Richard Nixon. Why? Because Richard Nixon was bold in foreign policy, right? He opened up China, cut a deal with China in order to focus on Russia. Well, you know, just the opposite here, or inverse, is occurring with Trump. He's cutting deals with Russia, or is going to cut a deal with Russia, in order to really pivot and put the pressure on China. That's a fundamental similarity between him and Richard Nixon. By the way, Richard Nixon was also this law and order You know, let's come down on the protesters, right? Law and order. Let's build up the police. And if he hadn't gotten impeached, we would have seen probably something in the second Nixon term similar to what Trump is doing right now. So other similarities with Nixon, you know, appealing to the forgotten Americans. Well, that's Trump's you know, mantra here. Well, with Nixon, it was middle America, you know. The silent majority, he called it. The silent majority is not silent anymore. Well, isn't that what Trump's saying? Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between Richard Nixon and the crook and Trump. Okay, and we're going to see more domestically revealed here as time goes on. A lot more similarities. So, you know, Trump is not something radically new. He's a continuation of developments that occurred back in the 1970s when we had another economic crisis then, and both on foreign policy and on domestic policy. We're going to see some changes here. Okay, so, you know, it's very interesting, these maneuvers going on this past week with Mexico and, of course, with UK and Theresa May at the very same time, right? What's going to happen next is going to be very interesting, right? Well, Trump says in another executive order and in speeches he gave to Homeland Security this past week and an interview, which we'll talk about, he gave to ABC, I think it was, David Muir here, right, as he walks along the White House and so forth, probably still up on the net somewhere. Some very interesting positions taken by him and attempts to draw him out on what he means by torture, and is torture okay? And, of course, Trump's answer to that in the interview was, yeah, waterboarding's okay. Yeah, waterboarding's not torture. And it's interesting to see Ryan and McConnell scurry away from that one. Yeah. Where does Trump come from on this? Well, you know, Trump's answer why waterboarding was okay is that, well, you know, ISIS is cutting off heads, you know, and we got to play fire with fire and direct quote, you know, so torturing is not so bad. It's not as bad as cutting off a head. Right? That was his logic here, right? So it's okay to be moderately torturous if your opponent is seriously torturous. Cutting off heads and so forth, right? And slaves, sex slaves of citizens and so forth. You know, it's okay to be not quite as bad and ethically challenged as ISIS, but you can be sort of like that a little bit. As long as you don't chop off heads, I guess it's okay to torture. Well, that's Trump logic, you see? Trump logic. So, you know, whether the security agencies and the CIA now with Black Ops being given the green light, we'll see whether we're going to be back into a period similar to that. All right. Could very well be. Could very well be. All right. So what else? This interview with Muir in ABC was also interesting. Because a lot of it centered around this whole question of illegal fraud in voting, you see. Trump has jumped on that, saying, oh, I want to, and he probably will have an executive order here, I want to investigate the illegal voting, you know. He thinks millions, 5 million illegal aliens voted, and that's why Hillary Clinton got 3 million more in a popular vote, you see. This is all an attempt to delegitimize the fact that Clinton got more votes, popular vote, because you can argue, well, you didn't get the popular vote, and therefore you don't have the mandate that you said you got. You know, it was only a couple, two, three electoral state votes here that put him in office that didn't put Hillary in office. So, you know, he's trying to delegitimize the fact that he didn't get the major vote, you know, popular vote here. So that's what's behind that. And similarly, the media talking about small turnout to his inaugural events. You know, he's fighting, pushing back on that piece of legitimation question as well. So this is what it's all about. You know, these attacks on the media, reporting inauguration numbers and attacks on alleged illegal voting. You know, it's very convenient because it attacks the immigrants at the same time. You know, these people are not only criminals, but these people have voted fraudulently, right? And we want to stop that. Well, this may also be a way of attempting, eventually we'll see, attempting to reduce the voting in these swing states, the ability to vote, right? I mean, if you say there's been fraud, what you can then do is, quote, take actions, and the actions will throw people off the voting rolls. You know, so this should be seen as an attempt to prepare the ground, maybe, for legitimizing keeping people off the voting rolls. Republicans have been doing that in a number of states successfully for some years, trying to restrict people who would not vote for them from voting. And there's been a running battle in various states and the federal government over attempts to prevent people from legally voting. So this attack by Trump on alleged voting improprieties by several million in the last election is an attempt, one, to legitimize himself and his voting, but it's also an attempt to prepare the ground for federal presidential nod to the states to legally go ahead and restrict the voting voting polls for next time. Okay, so keep that in mind. And of course, he gives him an opportunity to attack the press too at the same time, which he is doing and will continue to do. You need to look at these things in the long term of what's going on, because there's a strategy behind them. They aren't just anecdotal events. You know, it's not, as the press says, that he is just psychologically won't accept the fact that he didn't win the vote here, the popular vote. No, no, it's not so simplistic. It goes deeper. This is part of a strategy here. To reduce voting in the future. And, of course, it's part of his strategy for attacking the media, right? He is going to communicate by tweets with his base because he believes that the liberal media distorts his views, which, of course, it has. There's a battle going on with between him and the media that isn't going to stop, you see. And his Breitbart buddy there, Banyan, radical right buddy that he's got in the White House there with him, is going to take the lead on attacking the press, attacking the media. And it's already doing that. He calls the media the real opposition party. Well, that's kind of true, because the real elites in Congress are pretty much silent, pretty much agreeing, except maybe for the progressive caucus among the Democrats, who are a voice but a minority on the left, in liberal left in Congress. Pretty much, you know, they're going to go along with what he wants on taxes and deregulation and so forth. So, yeah, the media is the opposition party. Banyan is right. Steve Banyan is right. And that's why they're going to go after them, continue to go after them. The voter fraud thing, the inauguration thing, we're going to see more and more consistently of this. And it was it came out as well, the Trump attack on the media, in this interview Trump gave with David Muir, very clearly, you know. Every time Muir asked him something, not every time, but lots of times, he just turned it back on, well, the problem is you elites and the media, you elites and the media, you know, and that plays to Trump's base, because they've bought the idea that the liberal media is the problem. And therefore should be silenced, you know, and they don't want to see protests. That should be silenced too, you know. I mean, the hell with the First Amendment to the Constitution, free speech and assembly, you know, people shut up, you know. You shouldn't be protesting Trump, right? It's un-American. It's undemocratic. Exercising your democratic rights is undemocratic, right? That's where these Trump folks come from here. Okay. So what else has happened this past week beside this trade and the wall? And now the debate will be how do you pay for the wall as part of this immigration executive orders? How do you pay for it? Well, Congress has said, the leaders, Republican leaders, Ryan McConnell says, well, we'll pay for it first. So he'll be able to say, well, we're doing something. The question then is, how does Mexico reimburse? And will it reimburse? Well, we'll see how that goes. But certainly a border tax is going to upset business interests. As I said, a lot of U.S. big companies went to Mexico, send the stuff back across with no cost to them. And now if they have to pay a 20% border tax, you know, they're going to be upset. And we'll see how that plays out. All right. Another event here relating to Trump has been this resignation of six career officers in the State Department, right? Well, there's always a changeover, but clearly what's behind this is the Trump administration has told certain people, get out. We don't want you because you are really antagonistic to our particular views. And this ranges from officers who were State Department officers who were aggressive on immigration, preventing abuses of immigration, to officers who were part of the neocon group there in the State Department who wanted to provoke Russia and as a way of moving NATO further east, and also wanted to get the U.S. in a ground war in Syria. And these were the neocons, you know. Virginia Nuland, she's one of those who have resigned. Virginia, of course, a big private equity, Horizon Capital, finance capitalists, right, who was also in the State Department at a very high level, who was behind the coup in the Ukraine, funding it. And then, of course, she, and you don't hear the press saying this, she becomes, she's in the State Department, and she becomes at the same time the economics minister of the Ukraine. Yes, she's been running the economy of the Ukraine for a couple years now, since 2015. So here we got a State Department running the Ukraine, at least its economy, and in the process, I'm sure, divvying out good deals to American private equity and hedge funds here in the Ukraine, which, by the way, Biden, Joe Biden's family is deeply involved in, right? That's why Biden comes out, you know, for the Ukraine coupists and in favor of them ever since. He's got economic interests, his family, over there. He goes over there quite a bit. Well, Virginia Nuland was, you know, one of the big players provoking that right-wing coup over there, and has been pressing, along with other neoconists in, embedded in Hillary's State Department, to move NATO east and try to provoke, you know, with Russia with sanctions and so forth. That was the whole policy. But now you've got Trump, who doesn't want to pursue that direction in foreign policy, wants to turn to China. Wants to get out of the Middle East. Well, Obama wanted to too, but you know, Obama was a pretty weak president and couldn't really buck the neocons. And he did refuse to get in a land war in Syria, but drifted along with them in terms of Eastern Europe and Russia, provoking Russia here. Well, now Trump is going to reverse that because Trump wants to cut deals with Russia. And you will see those deals. That's why he appoints Rex Tillerson, you know, Secretary of State. And now the hard pivot to China is about to occur, as I predicted. So those people in the State Department, you know, were just obstacles to this change in U.S. foreign policy, and they've been asked to leave. Both liberals there, who obviously don't agree and will buck his immigration policies, and those on the right, neocons, who want to stay engaged in the Middle East and drive further in Eastern Europe. Okay, so that's my interpretation of what's behind the State Department resignations here of the past week. Now, he also brings in union leaders. Very interesting, right? Sits down with union leaders. Well, these are mostly construction union people who have always, union leadership, always been very conservative. And they sense an opportunity now to get more memberships from an infrastructure government spending policy program. So, you know, they're happy as pigs and you know what here. They're going to get more dues money and more membership and so forth. So he brings them in, Trump, you know, and they're all gaga being in the Oval Office. You know, I mean, union leaders, they always, you know, they've got inferiority complexes. And, you know, when the big politicians sort of stroke them, you know, they just purr and curl their tails and fall in line, right? Well, that's significance of that. It's going to be a strange White House, by the way, you know, with Trump the bachelor walking around. He's keeping his latest wife and son at a distance in New York. So he's a bachelor in the White House, although, you know, Ivanka, his daughter, will be there, sort of like a first lady, I guess, of sorts, right? Ivanka with the Electra complex. Yes, that will be very interesting to see how that plays out. Okay, so that is, you know, what has been going on in the past week, right? We got government by executive orders, immediate construction executive order of the border wall, right? And he says we're going to get rid of the bad ones, the criminals, you know. How many are there? We no one knows. But, you know, he could deport 2-3 million. That's what Obama did. It's possible. The apparatus is there to deport 2-3 million, right? We'll see. He's also had an executive order cracking down on sanctuary cities. Yes, sanctuary cities. Cities, you know, like in the West Coast and the Northwest and the Northeast that, you know, say they're going to refuse to crack down on immigrants. The way Trump is going to insist. And sanctuary cities are going to be a very interesting conflict here. 100 mayors come out, and they give their statements all at once that they're not going to do this, right? They're not going to go along with this. And we'll see what that conflict is going to be about. Well, he's going to pull money from the cities and let those interest in the cities who are getting the you know, the benefits from city spending and so forth, take it out on the immigrants, right? That's what this whole thing is about, and see how many cities buckle. Well, already Miami has buckled and says, okay, we'll go along with it, and a lot of others will silently buckle as well. Executive orders on immigration were also signed to call for 5,000 more border control officers and 3,000 more ICE officers. And that's what we're going to see, more policing of the wall and the wall itself, right? More deportations, all of this. Attack the immigrants. Attack the immigrants. You know, the new Jews? That's what it's all about. Attack the immigrants in our midst, right? The enemy within. All right, so, you know, a lot of talk, finish up here, a lot of talk, people have been saying, oh, you know, Trump is a fascist, he's a fascist. Well, people don't know what fascism really is, at least the 1930s variety. But there are some warning signs here, no doubt. To have fascism, you know, I've written about this on my blog, jackrasmus.com, in an exchange with a reader of and listener of my recent interview with the Global Research, that's also on the blog, jackrasmus.com. But basically, you know, my response is, you know, is Trump a fascist, right? No, he's not a fascist. But his regime is drifting in that direction. What do you need to have fascism? First of all, you have to neutralize opposition parties to have fascism, right? Well, are the Democrats neutralized? Pretty much so. You know, they're just a voice in the wilderness now. And if Steve Bannon of Breitbart says that the opposition party is the media, well, that means now they got to silence the media. Well, what does it mean to silence the media? To stop them from talking? No, to get them, put as much pressure as you can on the media, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, so they censor themselves and stop attacking the president. So they fall in line, right? It won't be a government shutting down the New York Times, but it will be the New York Times effectively censoring itself. So you got to silence the media one way or another to have fascism. You got to neutralize opposition parties to have fascism. Then you have to crush the protesters and whatever forces there are on the left. I'm not talking about Democrats in Congress on the left. That's not left. But you have to crush the protesters. Well, we got a lot of protesters out there, right? You know, Million Women March, and protests, you know, in environment, protests by immigrants, protests, you know, by Black Lives Matter folks, all of that. You got to crush them. And all this law and order beefing up the police is moving in that direction, of course. Well, in classic fascism in the 30s, you had to destroy the unions. Well, the unions in the U.S. have destroyed themselves pretty much. You know, they're a spent force. Totally irrelevant politically now, and barely hanging on democratically. So, you know, you bring a couple of them into, you split them further, bring them into the White House there, you know, feed them some cookies and milk, and then you, you have them in your back pocket. So it's not the 1930s anymore. You don't have to crush the unions. You don't have to crush communist parties or socialist parties. You know, you just crush the protesters. Right. Another element of fascism is when the government, leading right-wing government, allies closely with the military. Right. Well, we see a lot of generals in this cabinet, don't we? They're kind of almost rogue rebel generals, you know, within the establishment. But you know, their positions in these government cabinet and positions, you know, will drag a lot of neutral generals and admirals into their camp, right? It's early on this, and we'll see where the military is going over the course of the next couple of years or not, you know, whether the Flynns and the Mattises can win over the establishment in the military or not, which is now not pro-Trump, but could very well eventually be pro-Trump. And then finally, another element of fascism is this excessive nationalism and a focus on foreign military adventures. All right. Well, we'll see whether Trump, you know, allows himself to engage in such military adventures, which will be almost certainly in Asia. Right. It won't be in the Middle East, and it won't be, you know, in Europe and Russia. It will be in the Far East with China, right? That will take some time to develop. But the more that Trump may fail in delivering on his jobs and his domestic policy, the more likely it may be that he engages in foreign adventures, even military variety, in order to pump up his popular base support, you see. And we'll see. You know, the liberal media and the elites, traditional elites in this country, have not given up in preparing an attack on him. They're building the real dossier now. You know, his conflicts of interest, his nepotism, his taxes, which they really have already. You know, they will release that information when it's a proper time to go after him. But they can't go after him now. It's too early. And so long as he delivers on executive orders and follows up on jobs and so forth, it'll be hard to attack him. And besides that, the liberal elite or the traditional elites want to first get the horses in the barn. Big tax cuts for corporations and investors, deregulation of business, right, and deregulation of banks, and pulling, gutting and replacing Obamacare and Dodd-Frank. That's what they want, you see. So they will let him engage in this immigrant bashing and all this non-economic stuff while they're waiting to get the real objective delivered. But once the real objective is delivered, if he goes too far on this domestic bashing and gets involved in foreign military adventures that don't pay off, particularly if he just moves too fast on NATO, for example, then what you're going to have is the traditional elites will go after him. They're building the case. But it's not timely yet, you see. There's time to go. But watch it. Watch it. A lot has happened this past week, but it's only a week, and there's a lot more moves and developments underway here. You know, it's been a plus week for him on solidifying his base on the immigration issue, right? He's got Theresa May and coming in. You know, he's got her in the palm of his hand. He's got his executive orders on ACA out there, right? He's cleaning house in the State Department. He's attacking the press more, continuing. The press is falling for it, falling into his trap more and more. You know, the negative is negative for him is the problems with the wall and Mexico and a possible trade war here, very uneven trade war. U.S. could crush Mexico in a trade war, but Peña Nieto has no choice because he's so unpopular. He has to stand up, you know, to Trump to some extent. Plus, he may have been encouraged to do so by U.S. corporations that don't want to see a border tax either. All right, so that's the picture there. What's happening in Europe? Well, interestingly, there's infighting going on within the European Central Bank and governments over there, whether to continue the quantitative easing or not. Right? Some say yes, it should be. Others say no. Forces are lining up on that, whether it's necessary. Those who believe QE should continue are those who think that, well, there may be very serious political upheaval coming in Europe, in the elections coming up, and therefore the central bank's got to keep pumping the money in. And others say, clearly we're going to ride the crest of the wave here of the shift to infrastructure spending, fiscal spending here, and we should downgrade the monetary injections through QE, right? That's what's going on. Looks like the Greek debt crisis may erupt again for I don't know how many times now. Read my book, Looting Greece, A New Financial Imperialism Emerges. You can get that. It was produced late last November. The whole story of the Greek debt crisis as an indicator of a greater crisis in Europe, in the euro system and the banking system in Europe, and particularly the periphery economies, southern periphery economies in Europe. And prediction is it's going to erupt once again. And now we got a renewal of the crisis there. German Finance Minister Walter Schäuble has cut off negotiations with Greece, saying Greece is not implementing the latest austerity program, and of course it's not in some ways because it senses that Europe is unraveling, and that they may not be the only ones resisting austerity very soon, right? Another interesting development is the head of the Socialist Party in Germany has thrown his hat in the ring going after Angela Merkel in the elections here next year, come up, I think it's next August or September. Well, we'll see whether the social democratic dog has any bite left in Europe. He's pretty much been muzzled everywhere else. And, of course, social democracy, socialist party in France is devastated, and I predict will never return. Hollande, the president there, has a 4% popularity rating, 4%. So, you know, any of the socialist candidates over there running now for elections in April will are tarred and feathered here by Hollande's policies and so forth. You know, they're out of the play, and I predicted that the election, at least in the first round, is for the National Front's to lose, Marine Le Pen, right? I think she has a very excellent chance of running. Not that I think she's excellent, but it's the reality, right? It's the reality. And now the Republican opposition to her, Republican Party equivalent over there, Fillon, his name is now embroiled in a scandal. Interesting developments going on there. All the reason why Marine Le Pen, who has said we will take France out of not only the euro, but the European Union, not only out only of the currency union, but of the customs trading union. And that, of course, will unravel, accelerate the unraveling of Europe. You know, that's why the bankers say, well, you know, things are kind of risky here. We better not cut off the free money because if all this happens, we want to keep our bankers and investors floating here with all this free money. Okay. I talked about Mexico and emerging markets, the gas riots, the peso collapsing, inflation rising, the wall, all that, you know, big crisis point here. But in general, emerging markets, you know, South America and so forth, are rushing to issue bonds in dollars. They've already issued, you know, trillions of dollars in recent years, and that's going to come back and bite them big time. The crisis in banking may erupt the next one in Latin America, or it could be China, or it could be Europe, one of those three places. You'll see the crisis erupt next time. But the emerging markets are rushing to issue bonds before interest rates rise. dollar rates are rising, will continue to rise, and that will slow down the U.S. economy. Already we're seeing impacts on U.S. housing here, 10% drop in new housing construction, it's going to impact autos and a whole number of the key areas. So, you know, Trump policies may, you know, have a negative effect on jobs. All this talk about bringing back jobs may be, you know, greatly offset by rising rates and so forth. Which means that Trump and U.S. Central Bank, Federal Reserve Bank Chair Janet Yellen will clash at some point. They will clash, and we'll see whether Trump pushes her out of office before next year when her term is up. But certainly when her term is up, she will be replaced, probably by Fisher, who is a very conservative vice chair, but could be somebody else. Okay, China, we still got the same problems in China intensifying. China's cracking down on speculators again for the umpteenth time. And we have currency problems. Currency is devaluing, especially as the dollar goes up. You know, currency goes down. The yuan goes down in China and creates volatility and undermines China's desires to have the yuan as a trading currency. But doesn't have total control over that. And, of course, when the currency declines, you have intense capital flight going on. China is struggling to stop the capital flight, but it's had some success, but not total. And to protect the currency from declining and prevent capital flight, it's pumped almost $1 trillion now of its reserves into the global economy to protect the currency. How long it can do that? Well, it's got about $3 trillion more, but you know, that's a big chunk in just a short period of time. All right. So watch China. Watch the bond market rush in the emerging markets, which will have a big consequence down the road. In the U.S., as I said, interest rates are rising, will continue to rise, will bite into housing. Last week, we have a 20,000 Dow. Dow reaches 20,000, right? Record, right? Ah, but look, you know, there are five companies that are responsible for half of that rise. Five companies, right? So the Dow is not a good indicator. Right? The S&P 500 is a better indicator. For the U.S., news that union membership dropped to its lowest level ever, barely 10%. And in all categories, continuing decline. Union members, the unions are toothless dogs now. Puppies, I should say. Toothless puppies, right? They've allowed their membership to collapse. And that whole analysis, why the union movement has collapsed, partly because of offensive against it, but partly because of leadership. And the leadership being the weakest ever in the history of American trade union movement. And all they can do is pull on the skirt of the Democratic Party, which now has lost its skirt. Unions are not going to lead anything, anywhere, anytime in the foreseeable future, right? Okay. And we see companies courting Trump by saying, oh, we're going to relocate jobs. We're going to relocate jobs, right? Next week, of course, what we're going to see is a Supreme Court nominee for Trump, and he'll get what he wants. Okay. So, Congress, in the meantime, will plunge ahead with tax cuts for corporations and investors, deregulation focusing on ACA and Dodd-Frank, and the issue of the debt extension coming up in March. Okay, so this is all that we saw last week, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of news for next week. So let's watch that and tune in, and we'll talk about the latest Trump offensive and what the media and others are doing to stop it, which isn't much. Okay, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.